I mean, Marty Ford has apologized to Glenn Ford. Whether or not that apology is anything significant after enduring 30 years of wrongful conviction on death row in solitary confinement.
And the state still refuses to compensate
him financially. So he's completely underinsured. His medical care is a combination of volunteers like myself who are incredibly honored to be able to serve and work with Glenn, and then basic care from the state.
Well, Jackie Semmel, we will link to your exhibit at the Brooklyn Public Library that has just opened. The book has just come out again, Herman's House. And Frontline is doing a special on Glenn Ford's case tonight. That does it for our broadcast. We're looking to hire a social media producer. That's a full-time job. Go to our website. I'll also be speaking at Colorado College Thursday, April 23rd at 7 p.m. in Colorado Springs. Go to our website for more. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Sarah Mate, Nirmi Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Anna Ozbeck, Sam Riddell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of What the Festival, a music and arts festival June 19th through the 22nd at the Wolf Run Ranch in Dufour, Oregon. What the Festival features over 80 electronic and dance artists on four large stages, including artists such as Big Gigantic, Odessa, Rob Garza of Thievery Corporation, Toki Monsta, Thomas Jacks, Tropical Pool Party, Keys and Crates, and the Funk Hunters with Charlie Tuna of Jurassic 5. Again, that's the What the Festival, June 19th through the 22nd at the Wolf Run Ranch in Dufour, Oregon, just 90 miles east of Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Art of the Story 11th Annual Storytelling Festival. This year, Washington County Cooperative Library Services hosts its 11th annual week-long storytelling extravaganza, features 17 storytelling performances throughout Washington County. Performers in this year's festival include Judith Black, Sam Payne, performers from Portland's Brody Theater Company, and more. Again, that's the Washington County Library's 11th annual storytelling festival, The Art of the Story, from April 11th through April 18th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Workers Advocacy Group files $15 minimum wage ballot measure.
Clips from Governor Kate Brown's first State of the State speech.
And Oregonians gear up to fight the Trans-Pacific Partnership tomorrow.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 17th, 2015. I'm Kasiani.
And I'm Liam. Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the group 15 Now Oregon, a workers' advocacy group, has filed a ballot measure today for a statewide $15 an hour minimum wage. Efforts by the group to introduce similar bills into the legislature have stalled after political leaders in Salem announced that the issue would not be looked at this legislative session. But the group argues that Oregon's low-wage workers and families can't wait for politicians to act. They have decided to take the issue straight to the voters. The group will campaign statewide for the wage increase. It needs 1,000 signatures before the Secretary of State will draft the ballot title. After that, they have until July 2016 to collect over 88,000 signatures to qualify for the November 2016 ballot. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke earlier with Justin Norton Kirsten, an organizer for the campaign.
Sure. My name's Justin Norton Kirsten, and I'm one of the organizers with 15 Now Oregon.
Yes, we want to talk about the campaign to get a $15 minimum wage instated in Oregon statewide. And I was wondering if you could tell us what political leaders down in Salem have said recently about the two bills in the legislature concerning a $15 minimum wage increase. That would be House Bill 2009 and Senate Bill 610.
Sure. Well, there's been a lot of positive response around the bills from legislatures. We have a 16 sponsors on the bills. Unfortunately, it looks like nothing is going to end up passing this session. Some of the legislators have indicated that. So that's why we went ahead and filed the ballot measure, because honestly, you know, people can't wait to pay their bills or to pay their rent. They can't wait for the legislature to drag their feet. So if the legislature is not going to get it done, then we'll do it at the ballot.
What is the time frame for the ballot measure?
Yeah, we are trying to get on the 2016 ballot in November, so we'll have until July of 2016 to collect the signatures that we need.
Okay, and then if it came on to the 2016 ballot, if it were to be passed, voted yes by Oregon voters, when would it be brought into effect after that point, or is it too early to know?
No, so it would go into effect on January 1st, 2017, and it would have a three-year phase-in like the current bills in the legislature do. So it would phase in through 2019 would be when it gets up to 15.
Well, could you talk about why it's so important right now for Oregon to raise the minimum wage to $15?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Oregon's economy is growing at three times the national rate, and it has been for years now. But working people haven't been seeing the recovery that business here in Oregon is experiencing. People are falling further behind. You know, the average minimum wage worker only makes about $19,000 a year here in Oregon, and that's not enough to take care of a family, to put food on the table and pay the rent. And working people can't wait anymore, and so we need to raise the minimum wage now.
Could you talk about the support you've seen amongst Oregonians for $15 minimum wage?
Yeah, I mean, the support is really widespread, and there's over 100 labor unions and faith groups and community organizations who've signed on in support of 15. You know, we talked to people all over the state, thousands of people we've gotten signatures from across the state who support a $15 minimum wage. It's been really exciting to see how many people are not only in support of this, but are really excited to see it happen.
What are some of the criticisms that you've had levied against your group regarding raising the minimum wage to $15?
Sure. The big one lately with the hearings this past week and everything has been, what's the effect that it's going to have on small businesses? Is it going to kill jobs in small businesses? We find that it just is not true that it's going to harm small businesses. More people having more money in their pockets is good for small businesses. It means that they have more customers who can spend more money. And that demand is what drives our economy. It's what drives job creation in our economy. So this is going to be good for Oregon. It's going to be good for working people and good for the economy in general.
So there's another criticism that I've heard against the idea of a $15 minimum wage, and that's that once people who are on maybe federal benefits or state benefits, once they begin making a $15 minimum wage, they'll no longer be able to apply for the benefits they were receiving before, and there will be they'll be more economically disenfranchised than they were before. But there was recently a report put out by the Oregon Center for Public Policy that was kind of debunking this idea, and I was wondering if you could talk about that, what that report indicated.
Yeah, so it's this idea of the benefits cliff, for a small number of people that is a reality, where they'll get a raise to 15, and then after they lose their benefits, they might have actually lost a tiny bit of income, but there are really easy fixes that the state legislature can enact that can smooth out the process of transitioning from being reliant on public benefits to being self-sufficient, and the state legislature needs to make those fixes, and I think that the fact that those fixes need to be made can't be used as an excuse to prevent raising the minimum wage, right? I mean, I think the one thing that's going to help working people and low-wage workers the most is to make more money. When you have bills to pay, that's what you need is money, not public benefits and not health insurance. You need money to pay your bills, so...
So your group needs to garner 88,000 signatures by November 2016 in order to get a minimum wage bill on the ballot. And so what is your group, what's your strategy to obtain those 88,000 signatures?
Yeah, well, you know, we've been working really hard over the past year developing chapters and volunteer bases in cities and counties all across the state. And we're working closely with groups like the Rural Organizing Project that has organizations and people all over the state and in rural areas. And so we're really all over the place, and we're going to have volunteers all over the state really working hard to gather signatures. And, you know, with the sort of the help and support of other labor unions and other community groups, we're going to get it done.
That was Justin Norton Kurtzen from 15 Now Oregon, and this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
Lawmakers in D.C. are putting the finishing touches on an inside deal allowing President Obama to move forward with the controversial trade agreement known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. As we reported on last night's news, the TPP is opposed by a broad coalition of unions, environmental groups, civil liberties, activists, and internet freedom advocates. It's being negotiated entirely in secret with the assistance of 400 representatives from the largest corporations. The agreement level business advantages for U.S. workers, forcing living wage workers in the U.S. to compete with workers in sweatshops that make less than a dollar an hour in what is known as the global race to the bottom. In addition, the TPP will allow corporations to sue countries if those countries inhibit their ability to turn a profit. Also, Senator Ron Wyden seems to favor the deal because of new human rights conditions and the fine print. A majority vote in the Senate could completely derail the project. A protest against the TPP will be held tomorrow at Terry Schrunk Plaza at 3rd and Madison in Portland at 1 p.m. Senator Wyden's number in D.C. is 202-224-5244.
Now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A TPP trade deal fast-track authority bill was just introduced in Congress. There is strong opposition to delegating away the congressional authority of Congress over these deals. Fast-track gives the president, whoever that is, over the next 6 years, authority to pursue these agreements, to negotiate them in secret, and then all Congress can do is vote yes or no. No amendments, no congressional input. Global Trade Watch says fast-tracking the TPP would make it easier for corporations to offshore U.S. jobs. The AFL-CIO says it's launching a six-figure advertising buy against TPP fast-track that will be on TV and radio and in newspapers. The goal is to pressure 16 U.S. senators and 36 members of the House to oppose fast-track. Labor has been mobilizing a strong campaign against TPP fast-track. On Saturday, the AFL-CIO is organizing 50 events around the country opposing it. Since March, opponents of fast-track have held 400 events. Fight for 15 fast food workers walked off their jobs to strike in 236 cities. This week, tens of thousands of people took part in support rallies, marches, and demonstrations. Protests also happened in 100 cities around the world. In Los Angeles, a whole morning shift went on strike at a McDonald's restaurant, forcing it to close for a while. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich spoke to striking workers at a McDonald's in Berkeley this week. In New York City, tens of thousands of protesters turned out to add their voices to the demand of $15 and a union. Striking workers unfurled a large $15 banner outside of Brooklyn McDonald's, laying it down in an intersection. In Chicago, a dozen Brinks armored truck drivers spontaneously walked out on strike to join fast food workers. Even corporate media now recognizes that this is a vibrant and growing movement that politicians will have to reckon with in 2016. The Chicago Teachers Union is not amused by radical hedge fund billionaire Governor Bruce Rauner's comment that Chicago public schools should declare bankruptcy. The union says the comment reveals the governor's, quote, dangerous ideological extremism and his casual disregard for the damage that action would produce, both to the financial stakeholders, such as pensioners and bondholders, but also to the reputation and standing of CPS in the city of Chicago, end quote.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown gave the State of the State address today at the Portland City Club, focusing mainly on education. She also called on legislators to deliver a comprehensive funding package for transportation infrastructure in the state. During the question and answer, the governor fielded questions about the Nestle bottling plant proposed for the Columbia River Gorge and about climate change.
I'm Christine McCant, City Club member and a doctoral student at PSU, and I'm very excited about your educational agenda. But my question today is actually about something you said near the end. You mentioned having concerns about our water security in the state now and in the future, and I know you've stated publicly that you are in favor of a deliberate process regarding the Nestle bottling plant that's being proposed. But given your concerns, do those concerns you feel outweigh the economic benefits or potential economic benefits that a Nestle bottling plant could bring to the state?
Thank you. I think you're saying Nestle. Yes. And I was anticipating a question from one of the City Club members. So in Oregon, we have a very transparent and standards-based process for our rulemaking process. We have multiple agencies, including your Department of Fish and Wildlife and your Oregon Water Resources Department, working along with the City of Cascade Locks on this process. I know many of you are having your voices be heard by posting on my Facebook page, but I would also encourage you to make your views known. That's part of the public process by going to the Oregon Water Resources Department website and having your views be heard there as well. Thank you.
Mary Sullivan, City Club member. Thank you for bringing up the issue of climate change and the water supply connection. Thank you for signing the Clean Fuels Bill, but what is your position on cap and trade and carbon tax and approaches to dealing with carbon emissions?
Well, thank you. As you know, I passed an signed the Clean Fuels Bill into law a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it was extremely important to sign that legislation. That means reducing carbon emissions by 10% over the next handful of years, and I think it's really important that we have cleaner air. I think that's a good thing for healthy Oregonians. In terms of carbon cap and trade and some of the other issues, I know there's some legislation that the environmental community is moving through the legislature, but I haven't, in my 60 days in office, I have not spent enough time to be able to comment any further on that, and look forward to working with you to make sure that we have clean air in Oregon. I recently invested $1.5 million in making sure that we can transition out of wood stoves in areas like the Klamath Falls area. So hopefully we can continue to move forward on the West Coast as part of the climate change initiative. Thank you.
That was Oregon Governor Kate Brown at her State of the State address today at the Portland City Club.
Northwest Labor Press reports that a pair of resolutions are under consideration in Clark County, Washington, that would make it policy to, quote, advocate against requiring county employees to join a union as a condition of employment, unquote. The county has approximately 1,120 employees represented by 14 different unions. Union members turned out en masse at a hearing for the Board of County Councilors on April 7th, speaking against the proposed policies for over 2 hours of public testimony. The Clark County resolutions are nearly identical to so-called right-to-work resolutions that have passed elsewhere in the country. The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, supports right-to-work legislation across the country. Northwest Labor Press characterizes ALEC as a corporate-funded anti-union organization. Northwest Labor Press quoted Ron Robbins, a union carpenter from Camas. His sentiments were typical of the views expressed at the hearing. Right to work, let's not kid ourselves about it, lowers wages. There's not a state in this union where that experiment's been tried that it hasn't. So it's complete BS to say that isn't what it is. It's about lowering the wages of the working man. That's what Robbins said. The proposals remain open. County councilors emphasized that while they respect the organizing behind overwhelming union turnout at the hearing, they did not assume the showing to be broadly representative of public interest. Council Chair David Midori said, again quoted by Northwest Labor Press, "A packed hearing room does not an election make. What it really is, more than anything else, it's a measure of how well people can organize, and you're pretty well organized."
One of the bills passed by the Oregon House of Representatives today extends a ban on the growing of canola in certain parts of the Willamette Valley until July of 2016. Canola, along with soy, corn, and cotton, are the main crops in the United States that are genetically modified. Several members of the Oregon legislature spoke on the bill just before the vote, beginning with Representative Gorsuch.
In committee, I voted yes on this bill, and I haven't had a chance because I got here a little later than normal this morning to talk to my colleagues about this. But in talking to folks about the science side of this and the fact that the science is not complete, it does somewhat cause me pause. And so very much like my friend from the southern section of the state, I will be a no after all today. So thank you, Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion, Representative Barker.
Madam Speaker, to the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, a couple of years ago, I took a tour with some seed growers. They were very concerned about the canola growing. Canola is not allowed within 3 miles of the Idaho border because they're worried about the cross breeding. Oregon has a very robust seed industry for the brassicas plants. And the growers who of those seed companies tell me if canola gets loose, it will ruin that. France used to be the world supplier of those seeds. Canola took over there, and now those seeds are no longer considered pure enough to go in the market. Canola seeds float. So if you have a truck hauling canola seeds from the farm to the refinery, and a seed falls out, it rains in Oregon, that thing's gonna get washed into the streams alongside the road, the ditches, it will move down, they will, you know, plant or weed, and it will has a great possibility of contaminating the seeds. The seed growers tell me this will kill the industry if those get loose. And for those reasons, I'm going to be a no vote today. Thank you, member, their colleagues.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Esquivel, would you like to close?
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Nothing's changed. Nothing has changed from what we did before. We've just extended some growing out. Now, the canola has been growing in the Willamette Valley for many number of years. So you have not changed anything other than extension of a time frame and allowing people to plant canola in the same area as being planted today. So I urge your aye vote.
The bill passed the House today and goes to the Senator for approval. If it passes, the ban of canola in parts of the Willamette will continue until July of 2015. This means this legislator will have a chance to re-examine it next year.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight, a conversation with freelance homeless advocates about homeless advocacy and leadership. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, 75 degrees and all sunny. And Sunday, highs of 79 degrees and mostly sunny. Today in history, in 1961, a group of Cuban exiles trained and armed by the CIA landed on Cuba in an attempt to oust Fidel Castro, an event known as the Bay of Pigs invasion. And on this date last year, NASA's Kepler telescope confirmed the existence of the first Earth-sized planet orbiting within the habitable zone of another star. The quote of the day from Michel Foucault: "The strategic adversary is fascism, the fascism in us all, in our heads and in our everyday behavior, the fascism that causes us to love power, to desire the very thing that dominates and exploits us."
Thirty-three cities in the United States have laws or are considering laws that make it illegal to give food to hungry people. Some, like Fort Lauderdale, Florida, throw people in jail if they provide food for homeless people. These laws claim they're about protecting people from unregulated food sources. But the groups and individuals targeted by these laws say that the real aim is to keep them from shining a light on just how bad things have gotten for our country's poor, even as the homeless are treated like criminals for being without food and shelter. These groups, which include churches, nonprofits, and co-ops, say that charity work like sharing food with the homeless is essential in a country where protecting the poor and needy is never at the top of the list. They add that these programs to get food into the bellies of the hungriest people help those without shelter get back on their feet.
Yesterday in Kansas, Governor Sam Brownback signed a law restricting state aid, specifically Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF. The law specifies a 36-month lifetime limit on monies, and those without disabilities have to work 20 hours or submit to some sort of job training. Also, the money cannot be spent at public pools, movies, spas, or cruise ships. Critics have challenged Governor Brownback. They say the new rules are demeaning and imply that impoverished families that receive assistance are somehow able to afford luxury items using their meager assistance checks. TANF assistance ranges from about $271 a month in Texas to $789 a month in New York, the most expensive city in the country.
This past Saturday, in front of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., a man killed himself in an act of political protest, but no national news media outlet saw fit to report on the event. KBU News just found out about it because of an article on Alternate that compared the incident with the death of 64-year-old Vietnam vet John Valentino in 2013. Valentino set himself on fire near the Capitol in an act of self-immolation to protest the fact that voters have no rights in a political system that is governed by the very rich. That action by John Valentino, according to the Alternate article, represented a societal cry for help that should have pushed people to wake up to the inequality and injustice faced by so many in our society. But it went unreported by nearly every media outlet this past Saturday. A very similar scene took place in front of the U.S. Capitol when an older man walked up to a fountain in front of the Capitol. The man held a sign reading simply, "Tax the percent." Then he shot and killed himself.
He apparently did have a sign with him as well, in addition to the backpack and roller case. I'm not discussing the weapon at this time as well. That's all part of the death investigation.
It was
just a social sign about social justice. I don't have the exact language, but we can get that for you later. So we potentially know who he is, but obviously we have to secure that and verify that.
It's been 6 days since the unknown man killed himself as an act of political protest outside the Capitol, but police have released no further information about his identity or background.
Documents obtained by CNN indicate that National Guard forces referred to demonstrators in Ferguson, Missouri as enemy combatants and adversaries, raising concerns about the increasingly militarized and disconnected mindset police and the National Guard maintain when dealing with American citizens. The documents were obtained by CNN after a series of Freedom of Information Act requests. They were authored by the Missouri National Guard as it geared up to confront demonstrators in Ferguson after the police shooting of unarmed Michael Brown. One specific document outlined several groups of quote, enemy combatants, unquote, a category which included the KKK, the RGB Black Rebels, the New Black Panther Party, as well as those dubbed general protesters. The report also indicated that National Guard officials expressed concern over the increasingly militarized response to the civilian protests.
A new study by researchers at Azubu University's School of Veterinary Medicine in Sagamihara, Japan, has found that oxytocin, the hormone associated with love and affection in humans and animals, is released by both dogs and humans during love interaction with each other. This is the first time the hormone has been scientifically observed to link the two species and has wide implications for understanding why the human-canine bond is so unique among our relations to animals. The hormone oxytocin is released when humans are physically intimate, as well as between a mother and child. It is known to create a loop in humans, such as when mother gazes into the eyes of her infant. This releases oxytocin. The child then stares back, releasing oxytocin in its own brain, and both mother and child's oxytocin levels increase in relation to the other, reinforcing the feeling of love. The study demonstrates that a similar mechanism takes place between a dog and its owner when they gaze into each other's eyes. In order to test this, the study had 30 separate pair of dogs and their owners interact for 30 minutes alone together in a room. Afterwards, the researchers scanned the dogs and their owners' urine for oxytocin, finding that the more the pair stared into each other's eyes, the greater levels of hormone in their system. Brian Hare, a canine cognition expert at Duke University, believes this hormonal link is how dogs have managed to be humanity's most enduring animal companion since the Neolithic times, and clarifies why dogs are so useful for treating individuals with autism and post-traumatic stress disorder.